Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's March 1st, 2015, and welcome to episode 95 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's one thing I'd like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, living long, prospering. So, happy March. I'm joined today by two co-hosts, one Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
Hey, I'm good, Paul. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. Things are warming up. I always talk about the weather. That, for some reason, that's the way I define how I am.
Well, we're all very interested in Massachusetts weather lately. You guys have really been getting hammered.
Yep. And we've gotten a lot of snow.
Nicely done.
Also joining us from Toronto is Carrington Manston. How are you?
I am fabulous. Fantastic. I'm astronomically wonderful. I don't know.
Speaking of hammered... Good.
I'm tripping balls here in Canada.
Yes, and I've been told not to edit very much, but we'll see. Yeah, so today's topic is going to be the happy, joyous, wonderful question of what happens when the time comes that our collection becomes someone else's responsibility. What should we be doing? Those of us who are collecting now have certainly seen this happen. We'll pick up our piles of treasure from someone who's clearing out their grandpa's incomprehensible stuff from the attic, or you know, from the lady down the street who did apples in her garage. And so this is it's sort of an important topic, and it's easy to kind of just leave to think about in the future. But what should we be doing? Is there a time to downsize, or information we should be writing down for others? Are there organizations to contact for assistance, for those who are left behind, or should there be? And so we got this as a suggestion, as a topic suggestion, and it seems like a really important one, and I know I'm not doing it right, but it would be good to sort of see what we all think, and in fact, also you listeners, if you have ideas as well. What do we do when we get to the point that, what do we do to sort of help the people who are picking up after we're gone, say? So, have you guys had a chance to think about this? Earl, did you have any thoughts on it?
I do, actually. First off, thanks a million to Herbert for sending in this discussion suggestion. And we've seen, actually, in the various mailing lists and forums that we're on, this come up from time to time. Something happens to someone unexpectedly. It doesn't have to be that they, as Herbert put, go to the great recycler in the sky. It could be a change of life circumstances.
Or maybe the crystal in their palm goes black.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to go to carousel.
Right. So I have actually thought quite a bit about this. There's, I think, two or three different perspectives of this that you have to consider. First off, you have to know personally what you would like to happen to your stuff if you're no longer in need of it for some reason. Who do you want it to go to? Do you want it to be sold by someone? Do you want to, for the sake of your loved ones, your survivors, do you just want it to be given away just to get the headache, get stuff out of their hair? Do you have specific pieces of your collection that you'd like to see go to specific friends or colleagues that you've been dealing with over the years? So I think just first off, knowing what you want to happen to your stuff afterwards is a good idea. The second thing is, then you have to worry about the logistics. Who's going to step in and help out? Like, do you have somebody local that's a friend of yours that could help your family out? Because, I mean, I'm just thinking about it. You know, there's so much that goes on when somebody passes on that this is just an absolute headache for other people who are you know, left to, like you say, Paul, to clean up after you. So is there somebody that you know that could come in and take that burden off of their hands? I think thinking that through is a good idea, too. I've had a couple of instances where I have been on the buying end, the receiving end of estate sales. One was for some amateur radio gear, because aside from being a computer geek, I'm also a recovering radio geek. And in this one case, the person, the widow, just wanted me to make a blanket offer. And so I couldn't take the time to do all the full inventory and everything that I needed to do and price everything out. And this was pre-internet days, so I didn't have as many information resources either. So I made a blanket offer that I thought was fair, and she was overjoyed because she just wanted these things to be taken care of, go to somebody who would like them. So those are my thoughts. I think knowing what you want to happen to your stuff and knowing somebody who could help out to do something with your stuff. Also, I think a catalog of your stuff might be a good idea, too, because if I look around the room, the storage room where I have some of my vintage gear, some of it might be worth almost nothing, and other pieces of it might be worth more, actually. You could recover some cost from it, but are other people in that time when everything's in turmoil really going to want to understand, well, this is valuable and this isn't, you know? So just some of my thoughts. I don't know exactly how to jot all that down or catalog it, but it's not a bad idea, I think, to have a catalog of your stuff anyway.
Yeah, true. I mean, I think, you know, to the extent that we insure any of it, it's probably useful, though. I have to say that I myself have been totally irresponsible in this department. I mean, I do have a fairly good idea of what I have, not a very good idea of where it is. but it's true that, you know, there are things, they all look the same. They all look, you know, like some's junk and some's not, but you can't tell the difference if you didn't know, you know, that like this particular folded piece of paper and floppy disks happens to be like a really early game or something that people really want, you know, versus this other one, which is, you know, an AOL starter disk. So,
ooh, how much do you want for that?
Right. But so, Carrington, your collection is smaller.
Tiny, tiny, tiny.
But what thoughts did you have?
Well, like, I can see that, like you guys are saying, that in any given collection of people who are into retro computers, there's probably quite a sizable amount, maybe even the bulk of it, that is essentially not worth much. It's worth a lot to us because we love this stuff, but it's in small dollar values for each item. And then sometimes we have some things that are quite valuable. I've got hardware, and of all my retro computing hardware, none of it's really worth anything. I mean, it's not worth nothing, but it's really not worth auctioning. It's in some of the sealed software I have, I guess, would be the things that I have that are valuable. But even then, I'm not keen on my stuff. I like to play with it and then give it away. So if that's what happens after I'm gone, then I'm fine with that. But if I'm looking after my heirs, then it kind of makes sense that if you've invested in something and you have a collection that is worth something monetarily, that you want to get it sold ideally to people who will appreciate it, but also that you're going to get a decent amount of money for it to leave to people. So I guess that if you think along those terms, then the way to maximize that is to ensure that any pieces you have that are of significant value are not just lumped in with the great mass of stuff that might be thrown on eBay, which is one photo that says, here's a big collection, and only somebody will spot in the background that you've got three, you know, sealed Infocom saucers or something, and suddenly it's worth a bunch of money. I think the easiest way to do that is to like you guys say, do some form of cataloging. Maybe not of the entire collection, which might be a hassle. But if you're really into your collection, then it might be fun to catalog it. But I think you have to think in terms of somebody else has to step in and they're dealing with it. And it's either a bereaved family member or just as likely some sort of auction company who's simply going to pick it up. And if your goal is to look out for the people after you, then making that as easy a process as possible seems to be the way to maximize your return. So I would think you should catalog or note directly on items some way to link them back to a catalog. Like, so having just a big catalog, even if it's photographs or something, no one's going to be able to match that up because your stuff probably isn't worth millions of dollars. It's not going to an auction house that's going to put that effort in. But if directly on the piece, either with some like a removable marker or grease paint or something like that written right on the side of a piece of hardware that says this, you know, worth this much or here's what it is, or a way to denote when things go together would be nice, or sticky notes on things or on pieces of software. I think maybe cataloging them not as a separate item, but right on it. So if you've got box software, you stick a sticky note on each one and bingo, even if it is like what you think it would be worth, or maybe as you accumulate new things, if you're buying them through eBay, keep your eBay receipt and put it in with the software. So somebody can see, oh, he bought this 3 years ago and he paid this much for it. So it's probably worth more going forward. There's probably ways to indicate at least on the valuable items. Maybe pick the 5 or 10 most valuable things you have. Simply do those. You could probably do it in a half an hour and might really pay off a lot of dividends. It's a morbid kind of topic because nobody wants to take care of this stuff when they're alive. We all think we'll live forever and all of you but me are wrong. But it's the kind of thing that's nice to do. And I think if you approached it as a fun way to take another look at your collection, maybe combine it with a cleaning. So, hey, I'm going to go wipe the dust off everything, and while I do that, I'm going to put sticky notes on stuff or something along those lines. Might be a nice way to go, at least to the extent, if you don't want to look at values, to indicate what the heck it is. So simply if you wrote down this is what it is so that anybody auctioning it could go on eBay and do a search for that thing, or what makes, you know, first edition or signed or the thing that makes it valuable versus a regular, this is still sealed, do not open, that sort of thing, that can be useful. For me personally, my collection is not worth anything, and it's not worth insuring, and certainly wouldn't be putting anybody through college after I'm gone. So less of a concern for me than people who are seriously into collecting, I think.
It does seem like not a bad idea to try to deputize somebody younger, probably.
Good call.
That you know, might be able to just take over, you know, so rather than handing it over to some auction house or, you know, trying to have the next generation puzzle through this document that you've left them, you know, someone who's sort of in the middle who you know knows this stuff and knows basically what has been written, you know, that can differentiate a little bit on their own between. And so, you know, so of course you have to know somebody else, that, and they have to be somebody that doesn't live on the other side of the country. But I don't know. The other thing that you know about cataloging and writing stuff down is that even if you know have someone who's, you know, someone's offspring who's found, you know, all this stuff in the attic and is now trying to kind of like get it to people who care about it, they don't know the stories behind it. And I think, you know, that I've gotten, you know, a number of things where, I mean, so first of all, there's this mismatching problem where, you know, half the stuff was in one lot and half the stuff was in another. But I mean, the other thing too is that, you know, I've gotten a number of things which is just like a big jumble of stuff, and there was some coherent organizing principle, and there, you know, there was something about like, this is a program I wrote for this, and this is the thing that controls this robot, and, you know, this was given to me by, you know, somebody famous, and, you know, these are the things that it would be nice if there is a story behind any of these things, or just sort of a path that you followed with them to kind of make sure that that's out there somewhere. It's hard enough to find the time to actually play with the stuff. Writing it up is yet another step. So,
but maybe it's when you play with the stuff. It's like the when you touch a thing, like you don't try to do it in a weekend, but whenever you do interact with something, at that point you do just that one item.
Yeah.
It's funny to think that they're not making this stuff anymore. Like, the retro things, you know, by definition, it's older things. And as a collecting group, we're generally aging. So off over a long enough time frame, eventually one person has it all. There's going to be this one, like, lady in the future, and she's got everything that hasn't been thrown away is in her basement. So leave a note for her. Think about that lady 100 years in the future who's the last person who owns every retro computer that still exists.
Okay, any other thoughts on this?
Well, you brought up an interesting thing about the stories that go along with the computers. I also thought about what happens to the information that people have produced. And this might be a topic for a whole other show, but... for instance, what about the blogs? What about the podcasts? What about information that we've collected and have put various places, and it could be useful to somebody, but might just cease to exist if we pull the plug and nobody's paying the bills anymore? What if I stop paying the bills for Libsyn? Then the whole back catalog of Retrobits goes bye-bye.
Now, Jason Scott has your back.
We could push it to archive.org, absolutely, but... you know, are people doing that? Now that I think about it, I should. I should make sure the stuff is mirrored over there. So that might be another aspect of this, is the modern information that we're collecting or producing has value. So let's make sure that's in a safe place as well.
If there's stories with things, and sometimes that's the item of value, is the association or the way you got it or who made it or who, those sorts of things, I got to admit that it's also tempting to just make some of that stuff up and just see if you can punk the people that come after you. Absolutely. This was made by this person. This is what. Why not? Let's see what you can get away with after you're dead.
I got this manual straight from Bill Gates after I bought him a pizza that night when he was having a, you know, an all night coding session.
And put pizza in quotes and just let him wonder.
He still owes me $2.
Bill Gates, he knows what he did.
Yeah, excellent. So certainly I've thought a little bit about this when I, you know, when I open my office door and just look at this, you know, I've spent a fair amount of time recently just trying to sort and organize, and I have a just extensive, you know, Evernote linked, you know, thing with a picture of everything as I got it in and stuff like that, and you know, still I feel like I can't find anything. I guess the other you know, sort of point about this is just that we might expect when this is going to happen, but then again, there are, you know, reckless buses, right? So I suppose it's something that shouldn't wait. You know, it's not necessarily something for retirement. Oh, that was another thing I was going to say, is that, you know, like at some point you might reach a point where you say, okay, you know, I don't have that many years left. I'm not going to have time to do all this. And I, every time I think that, I think, all right, well, okay, so I should cut down to just the things I'm going to have time to do. I think, but I'm going to retire. You know, at some point, there's going to be this vast space of time. So I don't know how to make that decision. I don't know if anyone has any smart ideas about how to decide what you're going to have time to do and what you'd rather spend time doing than, you know, just trying to get the fourth, you know, iMac G4 to start.
I have plenty of dumb ideas on that. No, I might have one smart idea. I'll just say what my plans are, is that as I creep up towards 60, I think I'm going to start divesting myself of most of my collection. I'm probably going to wind up in
just one VIC-20
collection mode, kind of like you are right now, Carrington. Kind of,
yes, be more like me.
That's my goal, man. Very light on my feet for a number of reasons.
You're being less like me then.
One of which would be that I think at that point, probably my wife and I will move into a smaller place, and I won't have room to have all this stuff hanging around. It'll wind up at that point being more of a detriment. So just for me, you know, that's one data point that I've been thinking about that actually over the last couple of years. So I think that's my plan. I might not stick to it, but that's what I'm thinking right now.
What I'm thinking is, with all this talk of, like, you know, things can happen suddenly and what do you do with your collection, this has the potential of being the most ironic show we've ever done, depending on what happens in the next 2 weeks.
We need to watch our backs. Absolutely. Totally.
It'll be very interesting if next episode we're like, well, what a coincidence.
No getting hit by the beer truck, guys.
I do notice that a number of people that are normally on this show were not able to make it right now.
Hmm. I'm sure they're all fine.
Let us hope so. Okay, so I guess we've probably covered the beginnings of that topic. It might be interesting to sort of check in on our progress.
Yeah, let's not beat it to death.
Right. Let's see. So moving on, I guess we did get some, apart from the listener feedback that generated the topic, we did get some listener feedback. Earl, you wanted to mention this.
Well, Tez, as always, very helpful. He let me know that sometimes a TRS-80 just does have a garbage screen. You recall last time I was describing an eBay auction, and I was a little suspect because the TRS-80 Model 1 in some of the screenshots had garbage on the screen, and I thought, is that a bad sign? Apparently, there's times when it isn't a bad sign, when the system is trying to boot up from disk, there's no disk in the drive. Instead of giving you a nice little, hey, please put a diskette inside the drive, it just gives you a garbage screen, and that's supposed to be your cue. Who'd have thought? But Tez let me know that was the case, so it's very possible that TRS-80 on the eBay auction was indeed not broken, like I hoped. Tez says, there's other occasions, though, when that might mean it is broken. Garbage on the screen can mean a couple of different defects that you have to deal with, but not always. So, thanks a lot. I appreciate that info, and, sorry to the eBay auction if I improperly impugned the state of your TRS-80.
It is actually really useful to know which computers normal behavior is to display something that's kind of unpleasant looking like this. The original Apple IIs are like this too. You know, so people think they're broken. You know, they turn it on and the screen's full of garbage and there's just like an asterisk at the bottom. But that's just the way it is. It doesn't do anything else.
Sometimes you turn a computer on, the screen's full of garbage, and it's the way it is because that's Windows.
Right. Okay, let's see. So we can move on to items of interest and news. And if anyone else has feedback, of course, they can send it to us. I'll repeat that at the end. Carrington, you can start.
I shall. Thank you, Paul.
Oh, no problem.
Very professional. So John Carmack, and people know him, of course, fellow behind Doom. He tweeted out, I think that's the verb one would use, tweeted. He tweeted out a photo of his youngest son sitting in front, like on a dining room table, sitting in front of an Apple IIc hooked up to an old monitor. Just an adorable picture. And what really sort of lit the world on fire was what he wrote, which was, teaching my kids programming on an Apple IIc is like kung fu training in the primitive wilderness. And it turns out that yes, indeed, he, you know, is introducing his young kids to the idea of computer programming. And part of that is being done on vintage computers, particularly a 2C. Clearly a computer he'd be well versed with. But it's quite interesting. So there's a bit of a interview/article about it appeared in Cult of Mac. He told Cult of Mac, what's the quote here? The simplicity of print and plot with no boilerplate has advantages for your first experiences with commanding a computer. So the idea is, you know, very stripped down operating system, using something like BASIC, something where you can just type something and get immediate response, not have to worry about the modern aspects of computing, not worry about Windows, not worry about menus, not worry about threading, not worry about anything, just like type in some stuff, make a dot appear, type in other things, make a line appear, just very, very simple things. So it's interesting that he's still using a 2C to do that. So we got a link to the Cult of Mac article and to the original tweet. We can throw those in the show notes for people who want to see a photo. The photo's adorable.
Yeah, it is quite pleasing that the people are doing. I've seen actually. Of course, this is one of the most high profile ones, but I've seen this as a kind of a theme among parents who are retro computer enthusiasts. You know that I've seen on Facebook there are various posts of like, you know, here's my 9-year old, playing whatever Wavy Navy.
I think for me, not having kids, I'm going to have a strong opinion about this, naturally, because all people without children have strong opinions about what people should do with their children. And I'm going to recommend, I mean, this kind of idea, you know, sit down in front of a basic interface and programming, that's great and I think helpful. I also have really liked a large number of basic introduction to programming, or more introduction to programmable logic games have come out, particularly for iOS, for things like iPads and iPhones recently. And I think that also is a great platform to hand to a kid and say, here's a game, and secretly this game is going to teach you how to do a shuffle sort and how to do a ball, and the difference between them. There's a particularly good one called Cargo Bot, and I think it is fantastic. And this is what I would use to introduce a young kid. I got a 4 or 5 year old or 8 year old or something, and I wanted to introduce to programming. This is the way I would sneak it in. Cargo Bot is free. Basically, the idea is it's like a claw, and you drag in little things like arrows, move left, move right, move down, and ideas of loops, and it has 4 lines of what they call registers, and I even like this using those words, and it'll show you a picture of how the boxes should end up stacked, and then your idea is, okay, what is the way you can get this claw to move the blue boxes over here and move the red boxes over here, or move them all over into this end, or put them in a certain order. And it's nice, it's fun, it's free, I think the graphics are good, and it introduces concepts like looping, and you get, it's fully gamified, so you get stars for having completed a level, but the only way to get 3 stars is to complete it efficiently. There's often ways you can say with 25 steps you can move these boxes over there, but to get 3 stars you have to do it using 7 registers. Can you figure that out? And so I played with it for a while, and I was, you know, whipping through it. Then I got to points like halfway through the game, and I would do it and say, "Oh, 2 stars." I'm like, "What do you mean 2 stars?" And I would have done it in like 11 steps. It goes, "This can be done in 4." I'm like, "This can't be done in 4 steps." And it can, but I had to really think about it. And I've been coding for decades. So it definitely has the challenge there, but it introduces it really slowly. I think it's fantastic. I'm quite excited about it. So I'm going to recommend that. We'll have a link in the show notes.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, obviously it sort of reminds me in concept of like, you know, Rocky's Boots and Robot Odyssey and, you know, these, you know, games where you were supposed to be driving, you know, like building circuits and stuff like that. But this is something that like a modern kid, I imagine, could actually like, you know, sort of get sucked into.
It was funny. There was a thing recently where your president down there in America was talking about how kids need to learn to program. We need to put more things into school to teach kids to program. It's important. And I agree with the sentiment. Sentiment? I agree with the sentiment and the sentiment. And but I think for different reasons than most people do. Because I don't think it's vital to, like, get you a job that you know how to program. Because programming as a thing is probably not going to be, like, long-term a job for most people. Most people will not be coding for a living in any economy. But I do think that becoming a programmer at whatever level introduces you to logical thinking and accuracy and efficiency, and the mentality behind coding is useful in anything you could do. I am better at everything I do in all parts of my life because I can program, because then you can see errors in logic more easily, so you get better at discussions and debates. I can see workflows that can be made more efficiently. I am better at spotting spelling mistakes because I'm a coder. And I know coders are not often great with English, but you get to know this syntax requires this thing. I'm missing a period or whatever, and I'm better at spotting those things because with programming, it's not, oh, you did okay, pat in the back, go on. No, it compiles or it doesn't. It's right or it's wrong. And you get told in, like, immediate feedback. You try a thing and it immediately says, no, you have an error, and here's where. So I find it remarkably useful. I think it's useful for young kids as well. I think it pay big dividends. And I think we have benefited as a generation by being the generation that grew up with computers. And I suspect most people listening to this show were people that were the sort that grew up with home computers and got into it early, and they probably have benefited huge from that, whether they were programmers or not. And I think the more that you can expose kids to that, the better, says the guy with no children.
No,
Earl, you go do that.
I completely agree, have done that with my kids. I think it's interesting on this topic and also the next one we're going to talk about that people make the assertion learning how a computer works, learning the basics of programming and how logic works helps you not just with computers and technology, but in a variety of aspects of your life. What I'd be interested to know is, are there any formal studies that have shown that? Any sort of analysis by people that are a lot more qualified than I am to make that assertion? I'm just making it empirically, just saying the people that I've known that know those things are better at dealing with a lot of logical problems in their life. So I'd like to know whether anyone has done any like sociological studies or that sort of thing. And also to the earlier point of, is it easier to learn how computers work on an early computer? I think we've all thought, yes, you turn the thing on, it's immediately in a programming environment, you can jump in. We've talked about that quite a bit on the show. But I love the thing that you brought up, Carrington, about these games that teach you algorithms and programming constructs and give you stars if you succeed. I honestly think that's the way to go, because not everyone is going to have an Apple II or a Commodore that they can pull out of the closet and teach the kids with, but lots of people have the modern systems like the iPad that would have those games. That's cool. I didn't even know those existed. I learn something new every day.
Yeah, it's I note that it's written it is written in Codea, in fact, this cargo bot, which, as a beautiful segue, also is the next thing. So the next bit of news that I was going to talk about was somebody, what is his name, Robert C. Martin, is working on a PDP-8 emulator for the iPad, and it's written in the same sort of programming framework that CargoBot was written in, which is in itself, you know, kind of like separately from retrocomputing, kind of an interesting thing, because I know that Apple has fairly tight controls on iOS devices, and this seems like a programming language on the iOS device. Anyway, apparently you can build little apps in the Lua language. Robert Martin has done, he's put together a PDP-8 emulator for the iPad that does things like, you know, read paper tape and has, you know, nice little graphics of switches. And so he's posted a blog post, which is kind of, it's only sort of partly about the emulator, although he sort of shows screenshots of where it is now, and the current state of things is on his GitHub repository. But the actual point of the article is really sort of about programming style and how if you were actually using a PDP-8, you sort of you had to take a certain kind of approach to getting everything right pretty much the first time, because it's going to take, you know, hours to run your thing, and you don't want to sort of get halfway through and then find that there is a bug. You know, so work very meticulously in this style when you're working with these very old setups versus the kind of style that you would tend to use on the new one, where you can just, you know, everything compiles really pretty quickly and, you know, all the loops run fast, and so you can just sort of trial and error your way through, you know, sort of like rapid sloppy changes. And, you know, he's sort of promoting the idea that you can sort of have the best of both worlds by you know, taking advantage of the rapid compilation loop, but still being careful.
I think if I had a programming or a game company, I would call it rapid sloppy changes. I like that as a phrase. Also, this old programming, I'm for now, and I think I'm going to call tantric programming. It's going to be where you're coding the same thing, and it runs for days on end.
Yes.
Well, I wonder about this. I've heard this assertion made over and over, that back in the day when we had less RAM and computers were slower, that we programmed more carefully, and that was somehow better. And I agree with all of it up till the last part, that I don't know if I've made up my mind on that yet. I could say I used to write Clipper code. I used to write commercial code for this. It's a DBase compiler. And the machine that I started on was an 8086 with two floppy drives, and it would take forever to compile a program. Later, I got a hard drive, and then I was really styling. And that, of course, was a lot faster in terms of compiling the code. And ultimately, I got a 286 machine, and then compiles would just fly by. And I do know that I switched at that point from a more formal process to more jungle coding, where I would just, you know, flip things in there and just see whether or not they would make it through the compiler or not. And if, you know, if it compiled, then you'd call it good and ship it, right? No, I didn't do that. I actually tested. But on the other hand, it let me experiment more with different approaches to programming that I probably wouldn't have experimented with when things were so stinking slow. So in that way, the quality of the code went up as opposed to going down. So I just don't know. I mean, I know you were more careful in the past when things were slower and smaller, took more time to get the work done, but I'm not convinced that it was 100% better. I think there's pros and cons.
I agree. I think it's like saying that all haiku are better than all novels. That yes, maybe somebody who pumps out a haiku will spend more time thinking about each syllable than someone would think about each individual syllable in a novel. But a novel is a different beast and can perhaps say more or do things or take us on journeys that maybe a haiku cannot. So I do not think they're comparable. I definitely am a better programmer now than I was when I was a kid. I have learned more things. And yes, maybe in the past when I was on machines that were severely RAM limited or more likely cycle limited, where I had to really figure out, well, how can I do this and actually get it to work in the little bits of time I have to make a thing happen, I had to be more careful and more judicious of things. And, you know, I can see how maybe I've even lost some of that skill when you start working with the thousands of megahertz of worth of stuff. I got lots of time. But instead, I optimize other things and I do other things. And now I can code the equivalent of novels and series. Whereas before I had to make little tiny poems. And, I find that the joy in programming is in the beauty of it, is in the neat trick of logic that you do and go, oh my gosh, I solved that problem and it's solved in a way that is beautiful. And I had that feeling back then. I have that feeling now. And it just, maybe it's in doing different things, but when you solve that wonderful, like, logic knot and you figure out how to do something as efficiently as is required, given the parameters of the system and the deployment target you've got in front of you, that's where the beauty is. And I think coders are just as good now if, you know, just doing different things.
Well said.
Wasn't it, though?
It was. It was beautiful.
Now, Clive Sinclair, you've given us a great segue to the next bit, hasn't he, Paul? Hasn't he?
It was wonderful. Go ahead.
It's awesome. So Sir Clive Sinclair disagrees with you, and he took such umbrage, Earl, to what you said. He knew in advance you were going to say it, and back on February 20th, he posted his rebuttal. So,
well, that's because he's much more advanced. He travels around time. You know, it's not the first time he and I have disagreed. I'm going to have to ring him up.
So he is unimpressed with modern computing, and specifically addressing these sorts of ideas. A couple of weeks ago, he gave an interview that sort of made the news, especially over in the UK, but we'll have a link to the BBC site for both the video of it and a quick write-up about, he says that the things we've done with computing and the way we're doing it now is kind of dull, or rather dull, as he puts it. And he's not impressed. And he's really, in particular, not impressed with the stuff we're doing now, given that we have so much RAM, so much processing power, such massive GPUs and CPUs and everything at our disposal. He's arguing that what we do with that is not such a great leap from what could be done back when computers were really constrained in terms of RAM and power and what have you. And I guess he's saying, you know, we have a million to one increase in potential, but we have not lived up to that. We are not doing things a million times better. We're doing things 100 times better, given a million times the the resources. So that's the argument he would make. I kind of disagree with him, but I see where that mentality comes from. And somebody who was doing great things is thinking like, holy cow, if I had this back then, imagine the things I could have done. And your self-driving cars are not good enough for me. So that's what Sir Clive has to say. And we have a link to that in show notes too.
I think I agree with him in one respect, that Doug Engelbart passed away not too long ago, and of course known for inventing the mouse and pioneering the use of the modern user interface and that kind of thing. But not perhaps as widely known is why he was trying to build those tools, what it was he was trying to accomplish, which was to augment human intellect. So there apparently were two camps there at Stanford. One was artificial intelligence, and the other was trying to augment the intelligence or intellect of humans as opposed to creating an artificial intelligence. And that latter one, the augmentation, is what Doug Engelbart was involved in. And I just wonder, and actually I regret that I never had the chance to ask him about this, because he actually lived in Oregon here for a while, I know, for his last few years, but would he, what would be his impression of how far we've come toward that goal of augmenting human intellect? Sure, we've got the oracle of all knowledge out there on the internet now, but sometimes when I read discussion forums and that, I think that we've actually diminished human intellect as opposed to augmented it.
Is Paul making you call him the oracle of all knowledge? Because I told him we weren't going to do that.
Prerogative of the host.
And so, I mean, have we augmented the human intellect? In some ways, we've given ourselves access to more information, but so much of it is just plain dumb that I don't know if we've actually made much headway in that.
And is there a difference, though, between knowing a thing and that I can summon up in my memory and knowing how to summon it up using an external thing? Like, I don't know this, but I can quickly Google it?
No, I don't think there's a big difference there. I think the big difference is the word intellect. What do you do with that knowledge? And we're kind of waxing philosophical here.
Same thing we do every night, Pinky.
But yeah, assuming we're not trying to conquer the world.
Oh, well,
what do you do with that knowledge? And are we really being more intelligent now that we've got access to all this stuff and it's at our fingertips? And I don't know to what extent computing could have helped, but I know that was the goal back in the 60s when they were working on this stuff, so I just don't know how far we've come toward that goal. I got to go with Sir Clive on this one.
It's weird to think that the guy who invented the mouse was doing it to augment people. I have this vision now of like a Edward Scissorhands, but with mice on every finger. It's like,
No.
You want me to click that for you?
That's actually a good point, though, because the other interface that he designed, the cord, which you would play with your left hand and press multiple keys at once, kind of like a musical keyboard, didn't really get traction like the mouse. But
have you ever used one of those? I tried one, a cording keyboard, and I could just never was that right with me.
It just might have been too hard to use or something like that, but I'm just thinking it wasn't too far off of what you're saying there, Carrington. He was trying to augment the interface to reduce the friction between you and the computer so that truly, the computer could be an extension of you.
I remember having that discussion, almost argument, many times back in the day, so mid-80s, discussing the idea that I seem to be getting more and more efficient with computers, particularly mouse-based computers with a GUI. And yet, I see the trouble here, that I have a keyboard, two hands, and a mouse, third hand. And so, like, there is something inherently wrong with the idea that it's a three-handed interface designed for two-handed people.
Yep.
All my friends were two-handed. Anyway. I'm just saying. At most two hands. An average of no more than two hands. So we also have another link I just want to bring up that we're going to throw in the show notes, which is a link to therepublic.com. Not a great site. So I want to give people a warning that it's a site that scatters pop-up ads around like it's the Johnny Appleseed of spam. So be prepared. And yet, And yet, I want to link to them anyway because it's such an interesting little article. And it's the machines that defined that defined British computing. So I found this by sort of following the Sir Clive Sinclair thread. And it's really interesting, mostly because it's basically just a big list and some details of the big vintage British computers. And there's lots in there I already knew about. I'm like, yeah, the Acorn Atom and Electron, the BBC Micro, got it, the Dragon 32 and 64, the Jupiter Ace, the Orc 1. Yeah. And then it gets to the Grundy New Brain. I'm like, I beg your pardon? What is the Grundy New Brain? First of all, best name ever.
Yes.
And the Camputer Lynx. Yes, CAMPUTER. A Camputer. What was a Camputer? And something called the Alan Enterprise 128, which most people refer to as the FLAN. So a whole bunch of computers that were completely new to me. Maybe people from the UK would have been aware of all these, but I was not. So there's lots of the ones that sort of I was aware of even back in the day, like the BBC Micro, of course, everybody knows that one, but the Camputer Lynx and the Grundy New Brain, those were new. So I want to link to it just because there's probably a lot of listeners who also have not heard of the Grundy New Brain, and this is your chance to get introduced, but just be ready with your pop-up blockers.
That is, I don't even care what kind of computer this is.
don't you just want to own something called the Grundy New Brain? Oh, so good.
Yeah, so if any listener has a Grundy New Brain,
write us and let us know. And take a picture.
Well, it's just like a little thing, a little portable. Anyway, I love it. Love the name, the Grundy New Brain.
Yeah, excellent. Actually, you know, sort of tangentially off on that, and looping back to the topic before too, there's sort of this famous phenomenon or you know common phenomenon where nobody knows anyone's phone number anymore, right? You know, like there when I was a kid,
that's what we tell you.
You know,
that's
I knew
we're not called.
Right. I knew my own phone number. I knew everybody else's phone number. I could dial them quickly, you know, by heart. And I could recognize if I saw a number that looked like someone's phone number, I could say, oh, that's someone's phone number. Now I don't know any phone numbers, and I think that's one place where it's different, you know, knowing how to look something up on Google and knowing it in your head, because you can't make a unique creative connection if you didn't know the number, you couldn't say, oh, this number looks like that one number I know. Because you can't just Google, what are the numbers that I know?
There's no associational fluency if you don't have all of the facts to be fluent with stuck up in your brain.
Does it matter, though? I don't know most of my friends' phone numbers, but I know their Twitter handle. And that's how I interact with them more often. I know their email addresses. Like, I know that stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess I was just using that as a kind of like an analogy. I mean, for things that, you know, like sort of esoteric things that we know about computers, we might be able to say, oh, you know, this thing I'm just looking at now works kind of like this other thing that I know. Whereas if you had to actually, if you didn't know that, but you just sort of knew how to find that out, you wouldn't have been able to make the connection because you wouldn't have seen the commonality. So, I mean, I guess, whatever, it's still philosophy, but there is that sense in which we're losing something by having this like external knowledge base that you consult, because it's easy to be lazy. I mean, you know, the reason I don't know anyone's phone numbers is not because I no longer have the capacity. It's just like, what's the point?
I don't have friends.
and that, yes. Okay. Moving on. Earl, you have a YouTube documentary to talk about?
Well, I've pontificated enough, so instead I'll talk about someone else who frequently pontificated to great effect and made an amazing impact on so many sciences that it's just, I had no idea that this gentleman was so impressive. And of course, I'm speaking of Carrington Vanston.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
No. Sorry, Carrington. Not you this time. Next time.
Oh.
John von Neumann. No, I knew about his contributions to computing, but not about the impact that he had on other numerous sciences like mathematics, economics, atomic science. I guess he was part of the gang there at Los Alamos. Didn't know that. And there's a documentary, and I think it's actually from the 60s, made in part with a grant from the National Science Foundation about John von Neumann, and it talks about what he did. They have interviews with different people who knew him, and I'm almost all the way through watching it, and I just think it's fantastic. And I thought that probably our listeners might appreciate it as well. So we'll have a link up in the show notes. I think you should watch it.
Huh. Yeah, yeah. I didn't know any of this before. I'm looking through Wikipedia. I will definitely watch it. It's almost an hour.
I think he's almost superhuman. The things that he had an impact on, a Renaissance person living centuries after the Renaissance, where how do you be a generalist with such specialized fields of science that we had in the 20th century, but this guy did it. So, yep, have a look. I think you'll be impressed.
Well, speaking of putting your stamp on things, yeah, I don't know. Anyway.
No, nicely done. I was nodding in appreciation. That's a good one.
So apparently the Royal Mail in the UK has put out a new commemorative stamp for the Colossus and Tommy Flowers, who I guess invented the Colossus, and so I actually don't know all that much about the Colossus. It is claimed that it is the first programmable digital computer.
yeah. Let's argue about it now.
Yes. So it is absolutely the first programmable digital computer. If you don't agree, send us feedback at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. But anyway, you know, it's actually a neat looking stamp. It's got a sort of like a strip in the middle, and it's gray background with like sort of lit lights. Looks very, very pleasing, and it's also neat that they're commemorating it like this. I think there are a couple of other stamps as well commemorating things like the World Wide Web and stuff. But
it's a fad.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, so that was a neat bit of news. Anyone want to say anything
about
the Colossus?
I like this whole stamp series and the Colossus. I think it would be more fun if it was the other Colossus computer. If this is the stamp of Colossus, this is the stamp of World Control. I'd be all about that stamp. But I think this one's awesome, and to have a stamp that basically is blinking lights, you cannot go wrong with this. I think it's fantastic.
I want this stamp.
Okay. Somebody should send mail to Earl.
Yes. With that stamp, yeah. Just don't cancel it, because I don't
there's
want
There's another one in the series, because it's about the inventive Britain stamp set. There's another one we were talking about before we were recording that is the DNA sequence. And we were saying it'd be more fun if when you lick the back of it, the DNA sequence shown on the front is your DNA, and you can use that as a return address. You just take that top left corner, they go, it's me.
Very nice.
Talk about non-repudiation.
Okay, let's talk about it.
Okay. So I guess that pretty much wraps up the news. We'll now take a break for a vintage computer commercial.
Good night, Mary.
Good night, Mr. Albrecht.
Long after these people leave work, the Dimension PBX computer at their firm talks with a computer at Wisconsin Telephone Headquarters. Every night, it reports on the health of their firm's communication system. Problems, if there are any, are tracked down and corrected, often before the next business day.
Good morning, Mr. Albrecht.
Good morning, Mary.
You can rely on the people in the knowledge business at Wisconsin Telephone. Odyssey, video game fun, computer keyboard challenge, the entrance to an alternate world of fire-breathing dragons, hard-hitting sluggers, arcade wizards, outer space wizards. More than 40 games in all, Odyssey, the excitement of a game, the mind of a computer, all for the price of an ordinary video game, Odyssey.
And we're back. So today we have a retro computing gift idea that just showed up. This is David Larson, who has a blog called Bug Book Museum, and sort of talks about lots of sort of old and interesting vintage computer stuff. And he wrote that he had, as he was digging through his stuff, unearthed some 8080 octal code card slide rules. That was these things were created by a colleague of his called named Dr. John Titus, and they're really kind of cool things. He basically the reason it's a gift idea is because he's offering them for $10. He just located a group of 50 of them, and they're basically brand new. They're kind of cool. And so if you're looking for a pretty cheap little interesting gift, this is it. So it's a little slide rule just to describe what it is. I don't know. Actually, I have no idea how to use the slide rule, but it's a little card that has sort of 8080 instructions on it, and there's a little thing that you can pull out that I assume will... As you pull it out, it'll give you the different opcodes and the different modes and things like that. So you can sort of line up the windows, and it will give you whatever the instructions are in octal.
I'd like a little card like this for the 6502, mostly mm-hmm. just to remind me on opcodes, like what flags are set when. I mess that kind of stuff up all the time.
Yeah, and it's not that fun to there's a kind of a standard formatting for this kind of, opcode listing with all the, flags and graphs and stuff. And that's not fun. It's not fun to use. It's not easy to digest.
This could be used as cool. A great, old software would have shipped with this as a means of copy protection.
Right.
Say, okay, look up this. If you're doing this, which register changes to this? And I think that's what I would use this for. I like it.
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool. I haven't I've done absolutely no 8080 programming or 88 8 dot 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 8 programming. But if I ever do, this would be useful to have. Right. Okay, so moving on to further expenditures. We have eBay auctions, and Carrington, you can start this.
Well, speaking of Intel-based things, I will segue to that. I am choosing this time something called the Journey Inside the Computer. So it's not the Journey Inside the Computer, but the Journey Inside : the Computer. So I don't know if it's part of a series. But I do know that this was an educational kit that was given for free in the U.S. to and in Canada, I think, in the 90s by Intel to teachers if they wanted to have a hands-on unit to teach people about the computer, in particular, Intel-based computers. And this is a complete one that has shown up on eBay, $135.50 for a buy it now. And it's really cool. So it comes with a bunch of VHS videotapes that you would watch in class. Those are still sealed, and has both the teacher's guide, which is a whole guide to teaching people about the insides of a computer. What is a circuit? What are the various bits and bobs? How do they interact? That sort of thing. And also a chip kit, because it comes with samples. Like, here is a wafer that you can hold and look at. And also ships with a bunch of batteries. This shows it with batteries, but he says they're going to ship it without the batteries, I guess, because nowadays it's hard to ship batteries. But they're just regular C and D cells, I think. I don't know, just regular batteries. But it does come with a bunch of little connectors to attach to, like the 12-volt batteries that are in it. And then you make circuits. So it teaches you about circuit logic and teaches you about the interior of a computer, stuff that Intel might want you to be, knowledgeable about. And I think it's really cool. So it comes in like a little box with a handle, and I hadn't seen one of these before, so I found a link to a nice site called chipsetc.com. I guess that would be pronounced. It's the Vintage Computer Chip Collectibles site, and they have a whole page about this sort of kit, and there were various versions of it throughout the 90s, so you can sort of look up which version this is. I think it's the third version, so it's late 90s, and it's neat. So I think it was a neat sort of thing, so I'm selecting that as my eBay auction choice. Have either of you guys ever seen one of these before?
Huh. Cool. Yeah, well, it shows up on my searches. I've seen this or things like it go by a couple times, and every time I do sort of like click and look and think, that might be kind of interesting. It's a cool thing. I'm never quite there to actually hit the buy button though.
No, I wouldn't either. I had not encountered it because I really don't play in the Intel space. So this was news to me. I have a couple little quick alt selections as well. One is there's a nice three binder set of the complete set of Apple II and Macintosh technical notes. So it's the user group binders, and I like it. So these things are, you know, you can come buy the PDFs online right now, but if you want a nice collected copy in a neat binder of every technical note issued back in the day for both Apple II and Macintosh, so it's got the full Apple II binder and then the two big Macintosh binders, so it's a lot of stuff. Now, $150, so not cheap. But neat. So if you're looking for technical notes, they are available on eBay right now as a buy now. And the third one is Sinclair, because I had Clive on the mind. A fellow is, and I don't think this is worth it, but it's kind of neat to see, the entire Sinclair software collection. There's lots of software for the ZX80, but there were only so many titles that were actually Sinclair brand. And this is an auction for the complete set. So, if you got a ZX81 or you want to have a ZX81, this is a way to jump right in one fell swoop get every Sinclair brand software title that was available for the ZX80. It's £99.99, so I think quite a bit of money for what is essentially a collection of 30 or 40 cassette tapes, but it's kind of neat, and so that's my third choice. Lots of little things for people to buy, none of which I would pull the trigger on, but they're all kind of cool to look at.
Yeah, I think that's really neat, actually, to see. I agree that I probably wouldn't buy it, but it's really neat to see all the ZX81 tapes.
Yeah.
What's interesting, so I have a number of the ones for the, you know, the Timex Sinclair. I don't recognize any of these, though. I mean, like, it's possible that some of these are the same, but they don't, you know, the branding's all different.
Well, and also there was lots of software that wasn't, you know, Sinclair brand. It would have been just other people's stuff. I like it because I never played in that space back in the day. I did have a ZX81, I think, or maybe it was the Canadian version. Briefly, when I was a kid, I had access to the stuff and the black and whiteness of it, and I didn't really dig it. But what I like about BBC Micro, the Sinclair, the ZX81, all those, is because they're from really a different computing world than me, there's tons of games, and all I know about them is the title and sometimes the graphic. So when I get to look at this, I'm like, here's a game called Adventure A, Planet of Death. I absolutely want to play a game called Planet of Death.
Right.
And Adventure C, the Ship of Doom. Yes, please. I want to play a game called the Ship of Doom. Maybe these games are terrible, but they appeal to me in the same way that games used to appeal to me, where all you got was the title and the promise of this cool adventure or action game that could be available for your home micro. And so that these games still hold that appeal for me, probably because I have not played them.
Right. Earl, okay. Hey, you have the next eBay thing on the list here.
Mine's a real simple one. So I'll make it more complicated.
Excellent.
I'll say that some of the computers that I use, I want to keep them in their pristine state and use them like they were back in the day for the nostalgia. And other systems that I have, I just want them to work and be accessible. And my IBM PC is kind of like that. I've got a 5160, the IBM XT. And I honestly don't care what kind of hacks I make to it as long as the thing works. Including if the power supply ever goes out, I might try and figure if there's some way to hack a modern ATX power supply onto it or whatever. So my auction pick is a VGA card that will work with either XT or AT systems. We've talked before about the old monitors going bye-bye over time, but VGA monitors are still pretty stinking plentiful, and even VGA flat screens. So I wouldn't mind having a VGA interface card for my PC XT, because that would make it a lot easier to hook up, and I wouldn't have to worry about having a CGA monitor handy. So this card has been tested. They say it's used. I mean, pretty much, of course. Occasionally, you'll still find some ISA cards new in the box, but not as often. But this one's been tested and it works. They specifically tested it in, I can't remember if, was it a 5160? Yep. Or no, a 5150.
Yeah, that's interesting. It says that it works with the XT, but I have tested this adapter with my IBM 5150. So that's cool.
Right. So I guess PC, XT, whatever, 8-bit, 16-bit, whatever you got, this should work, and it's $25. Buy it now for free shipping. So I thought the price was reasonable too. And these kind of components, if what you're trying to do is just have a machine that works, I've got some software on the way that I want to play with. I talked about Clipper a little while ago. I've actually located a Clipper Summer 87 version, the one I used to use, and someone is sending it to me for just the cost of postage, which I thought was amazingly cool. When I get it, I want to play with it. And I want to play with it on a real computer, not an emulator, but, you know, it's a drag to try and dig out the old monitors and that. So this is what I want. I want a VGA card like this.
Yeah, and as I recall, actually, if you plug the wrong monitor in to your, if you have a mismatch between whatever it is, you know, monochrome and CGA, you know, then you're likely to blow one or both of the things you connect.
I think you can, yeah, let out the magic smoke, right?
So, yeah, I have yet to build it, but I have a hard drive kit that's supposed to work in a. In like a 5150 or 5160. I think it's a IDE flash interface. I would also like to use the old 51XT things, but I just am not sure if I can handle making these like single sided disks. So someday I'll build that. Okay, anyway, off track. Next, the eBay auction that I have picked is actually, there's no chance that it will, well, there's a tiny little bit of a chance that it will still be available by the time this actually gets out onto the feed. But I will mention it anyway. It's the Best of Creative Computing Volume 1, which is, so the thing that's notable about it and, you know, sort of, somehow this seems not to have been mentioned yet, but Leonard Nimoy just passed away, and so there's things that have to do with Spock and Leonard Nimoy and Star Trek and stuff are sort of on the mind of the internet and mine as well. What's sort of notable about this book, it's a compilation basically of, I think, the first year, maybe year and a half of the Creative Computing magazine, and it has on the cover of it, it has ASCII art. Picture of Spock, and then, you know, sort of inside there's a one of the, it's sort of a collection of articles, usually programs and things that were in Creative Computing, and one of the things was Super Star Trek, you know, which was, you could type in and modify to your particular version of BASIC. Just as a, so even though this particular auction will end, these books are findable. So there will be another auction. You can at least see what the picture of it looks like. I dug into this a little bit, and the original, both the original ASCII art and the original Super Star Trek came from May, June 1975 Creative Computing issue. And actually, that issue, so that's not listed anywhere on eBay at the moment, but that issue has a, it's actually sort of a, it's like a two-page spread of this ASCII art. So it's even more ASCII art than you get in the Best of Creative Computing. So there is one, well, so first of all, anyone have sort of recollections of this magazine?
Well, I recognize that Spock guy.
Yeah.
This was before my time.
Yeah, I definitely read the occasional issue, because Creative Computing kept going, of course, for a lot of years. And I know that I, because I was a little bit of an Apple snob at the time that I was reading these things, and so I didn't go for it as much, just because it's kind of a generalist magazine. You know, the stuff in there was mostly not platform specific. So, you know, I would rather get a Nibble than Creative Computing.
And isn't this available now in a modern ebook form? I thought there was a project that Kevin Savitz had something to do with to get some of these Creative Computing compendiums out there and available, purchasable in an ebook form. Am I hallucinating?
It sounds vaguely familiar. I know that Kevin is definitely responsible for getting a lot of these scanned. So could be. I'm not sure. One of the things, though, that actually led me to go ahead and list this is that it's also, incidentally, it turns out that if you look at this particular auction, it says, where does it say this? Oh, maybe it doesn't say this. But okay, so on other auctions that are current from this seller, it says that, you know, inside the book, it's, you know, it's written Dave Haney, but otherwise it's in good condition. And in fact, if you read some of these other listings, I guess not on this one, but he says, well, autographs are, you know, I can autograph things if, you know, by request, but otherwise, you know, things won't be signed. So I thought that's a weird thing to put in an auction. but it turns out actually that, so the person who is, whose auction this is and whose book you would be getting if you managed to see this auction in time is Dave Haney. It's not a name I knew, but Earl, it's a name you might know.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So he was primary engineer on the, Amiga 2000, I guess. Anyway, maybe you can say a little bit more about that. But I think that was kind of neat, actually. You know, that this is going to be something. You should write a note to your heirs. This book belonged to this guy.
Yep, that actually is really cool.
So it might be worth keeping an eye on, you know, particularly if you're in a kind of like a Commodore mindset, keeping an eye on what he lists, because it's apparently he's moving. You know, this is Dave Haney's moving sale. And so these are things that have, there's some interesting stuff there too, but unfortunately, you know, at least the things that are listed now will end soon. But it's worth going to this listing that's in the show notes and, you know, seeing the other items to see what else comes up.
And I verified that some of these creative computing compendiums are out there in ebook form. From Kevin Sabbats. You can find them up on Amazon. So that's really cool. And I read one of them, and it wasn't just about this is how you put the floppy in and make the computer work, and these are the bits and bytes. They actually got really philosophical, like we kind of have on this episode, about computing and what it was going to do in the future and how people would use it and what were the ethical implications. And I think that not only are these interesting because they're historic, but they're just thought-provoking, even still today. So, fun stuff.
Yeah, it's I'm accumulating more things to read than I have time to read them, but this is now on my list as well. So, I guess we've made it through the eBay auctions that were on the list, and perhaps we are at the point where we can have closing discussions. So, Carrington, you have a couple things.
I do indeed. Yes, I'm going to. Well, really, it's one thing with two links. I'm going to point people over to the Planet Money podcast, which isn't really a podcast that I listen to, but I always hear good things about. They recently did a show on the history of spreadsheets. I guess because they're related to money and such. And of course, I think of when I think spreadsheets, I think VisiCalc as the one of the first big killer apps. And so if you're interested in spreadsheets and spreadsheets and their history and impact and all that could be a show topic for us as well. So maybe in a little bit of homework for everybody, go listen to that and we can talk about it in some future episode. And so Planet Money has the history of spreadsheets. Cool, listen. And then that led me over to on Medium.com, Stephen Levy wrote about spreadsheets as well, and spreadsheet history, and really writing from the point of view of a time when he had to explain to somebody what a cursor was. So it's that early, and the idea of, no, when you move it, this little thing's going to move on screen, and it's a representation of your point in the spreadsheet, and sort of just dealing with spreadsheets in that period. Really interesting, really well-written piece. So I'm going to point people at both of those, and I'll have links in the show notes.
And if you're interested in spreadsheets, Bob Frankston is going to be speaking at the Vintage Computer Festival East that's coming up. Of course, the co-creator of VisiCalc, along with Dan Bricklin.
So there you go.
Yeah, no, it's great, exactly. Very, very timely.
Yes. Oh, me. If you're interested in spreadsheets, you're the kind of party animal we want to hang out with.
Earl, so you've been making discs?
I've been cooking up a few discs. If you guys can picture in your mind our founder, David Grealish, carting around a K-Pro, but he has a sad face because he doesn't have discs for the K-Pro. And so it's actually taken me longer than it should have, but I had to figure out, how do I get this stuff off the internet and put it in CPM form? And there are a couple different ways that I talk about if anybody is trying to do this. First off, you need a machine that has a 5 1/4 disk. So I use the 5160 that I was talking about a few minutes ago, my PCXT. And I get stuff on and off there using a zip drive that hooks to the parallel port. There's one software package written for DOS called ImageDisk that you can find on Dave Dunfield's site. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. You get ImageDisk, and you get one of these diskette images, and you say go, and it knows how to cook up that disk image onto a 5 1/4 floppy so that you can use it on your CPM machine. But let's say you want to get individual files, then you need some shareware that's been shareware since the 90s, so not convinced it's shareware anymore, but go find it. It's called 22disk. And it will let you move files back and forth between CPM format and DOS format. And it supports, I think the official number is a gajillion. It supports a gajillion different CPM formats and very handy piece of software. And so the combination of those two I use to get some stuff so that I can now ship it across the country to the greater Atlanta area. And that's just one retro thing I've been up to that I thought might be interesting for folks. And if you got CPM, there is a way. CPM lives.
Cool. Yeah, I remember it's been a long time now since I've done anything with this, but I remember, I think it was 22 disks that was actually pretty hard to find. That or Teledisk. One of these, you know, there, at least for a while, it seemed like there was a fairly aggressive campaign to keep it, you know, keep it shareware, keep it off the public net. Is it true that the 22disk is still possible to pay the shareware fee?
I'm not sure. It seems like the company that made it is still in business. They and I think maybe they're even in Eugene, Oregon, a couple hours from me. Don't quote me on that, listeners. But they don't obviously have that software package anymore anywhere on their website. I looked around for it, and I don't know how they'd take a shareware donation. I just don't know. Maybe it's something to look into. I mean, it's useful enough that I wouldn't mind paying a incidental fee for it, because I've used it in the past as well and have had good luck, but you're right. I did have to work a little bit to dig it up.
Let's see, and what have I been doing? I'll have something interesting to report next time, I will say. I've continued to like take various computers and try to mix and match things, and so I've recently installed some operating systems and hard drives, and trying to get, I'm inching closer to this data recovery project that I'm in the midst of, but until I get there, I can't talk about what the data is that is going to be recovered, we hope. But anyway, so I've had a little bit of retro frustration in a way, reminding myself how good we have it now. And I guess that's it, unless any other closing thoughts?
I have no thoughts at all.
My mind is empty.
Okay, so that'll wrap up this show then. You can find the show notes for all of the shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss in the forums at vintage-computer.com/vcforum. You can follow the RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast, where tweets are now many more than they
are actually tweeting something.
And if you want to complain about what the actual first digital computer is, you can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. And if you have a chance, please write a review on iTunes. That helps bring us up in the listing rankings and helps people find the show. And so, then, until next time,
Retro Compute!